Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Oil is over $56 a barrel today. Reserves, we're told, have nearly peaked. Terrorists threaten supplies. Global warming is here. And the fast-growing economies of China, India, and more have a ferocious, competitive new appetite for fuel. The long era of cheap, abundant oil is coming to an end. And debate in Washington is boiling over exactly what to do about it. Congress is up to its neck in energy policy right now, in House and Senate versions of a massive new energy bill. In it is everything from tax breaks for hybrid vehicles to multi-billion dollar sweeteners for ethanol producers. The Senate bill is front and center right now, and supporters say it's a step in the right direction. Critics smell big giveaways, but not big vision. But almost everyone agrees, from environmentalists to steely security hawks, that forming a strong energy policy is now critical to America's future. Tonight on Point, America's energy survival and the bills on Capitol Hill. We begin tonight in Washington, where the Senate just hours ago voted on two key amendments to its version of the energy bill. Joining us with the latest on where the legislation stands is Justin Blum, energy reporter for The Washington Post. Justin, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So what is it that was voted on today?
Well, there were two amendments that were taken up by the Senate today. One, which passed, was sponsored by Senator Jeff Bingaman of New Mexico, that would require 10% of electricity sold to consumers come from renewable sources by the year 2020.
That sounds like a big deal. What percent comes from alternative sources today?
It's pretty small now, and it depends on where you are in the U.S. Some states recently have passed measures similar to the one approved by the Senate today. The House, though, which has passed its own version of the energy bill, did
yes.
not include any sort of renewable electricity requirement, and so this is an issue that will have to be taken up in conference committee.
A lot, maybe everything, ultimately decided in conference committee, but we're interested in what the Senate's doing. So that passed today, but another amendment failed. This was the Cantwell amendment.
The Cantwell amendment, which was sponsored by Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington State, set a goal of reducing U.S. dependency on foreign oil by 40% in 20 years. The amendment narrowly failed.
And straight along party lines, or is that the way things are going with these bills?
With this bill, it really depends. Some votes are along party lines, but a lot of votes break down along regional lines, depending on the issue.
What are the politics here, Justin? We're reading about a glasnost here that, not in the House perhaps, but in the Senate, a kind of centrist coalition emerging that really is serious about wanting to do something about energy independence, energy security, and global warming here. Is that clearly evident or not?
Yeah, there's definitely a change in the way Republicans and Democrats are dealing with each other on this legislation. In previous years in the Senate, the energy bill has been pretty contentious. And in fact, 2 years ago, when the Senate took up the energy bill, there was a filibuster that caused the bill's defeat. And so this time around, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, along with the Republican who chairs the panel, have been working really closely together, and they came up with a bill that was pretty palatable to both Republicans and Democrats on the committee. When the committee passed the bill, there was only one vote against it. One Democrat voted against it. Everyone else for it.
And interestingly, we've got two New Mexico senators here, Pete Domenici and, as you said, Jeff Bingaman.
Right. Jeff Bingaman is the ranking Democrat on the committee, and Pete Domenici is the chairman of the committee, and so the two of them have been for weeks working very closely together and coming up with policies that both sides
Can you give us a sense of the major provisions of the Senate bill as it stands now, Justin? And I know it's huge, but the big pieces.
It is huge. Overall, the goal of the bill is to try to provide incentives for more domestic production of various forms of energy. There are all kinds of tax breaks and incentives for in the Senate bill for nuclear power. The Senate bill focuses more heavily on providing incentives for cleaner burning forms of energy, but it also seeks to increase domestic production of oil and natural gas, and there are some tax breaks too for oil and natural gas, while the House bill is much more focused on oil and natural gas.
Do both the House and Senate bill open up the ANWR reserve in Alaska for drilling?
Well, the House bill would open the reserve for drilling. The Senate bill doesn't include the language, but really this issue is going to be dealt with as part of the budget. Both chambers have passed budget resolutions that call for drilling in ANWR, though final votes on this still need to be taken.
Ethanol is a big piece of the Senate bill. Can you explain what's going on there?
The Senate bill includes a mandate that million barrels of ethanol be used, and the House bill calls for less ethanol to be used than the Senate bill.
This is 8 million per day?
I believe so.
Most of the things we're talking about here are units of the day. That means a whole lot of corn production to make biofuel. Is that to be used on its own or as an additive to gasoline?
It's to be used as an additive to gasoline, and the idea is that increasing the ethanol mandate would displace some amount of gasoline and therefore reduce imports.
And how are people taking this on Capitol Hill? They're talking about $16 billion or something on that order here. Is it being described, these incentives for domestic energy production, are they being seen as, you know, legitimate, credible, necessary incentives to move the country toward more independence and maybe a greener energy profile, or are they being seen as boondoggles?
Well, it depends who you ask, and it depends which side of the issue you're coming at it from. There are a lot of environmentalists and tax groups that look at a lot of these incentives as giveaways for industries that are already making handsome profits with high energy prices. There are some incentives that environmentalists favor that aren't as popular with members of Congress who think that these incentives would artificially prop up industries that don't need the help.
So there's the latest from the Senate. Soon they will go into conference with the House, and what comes out, we'll have to wait and see. The House, a more conservative bill, as you say. Justin Blum, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Justin Blum, energy reporter for The Washington Post. He spoke with us from Washington. We are talking tonight about America's energy future and the very consequential legislation working its way through Congress right now. You can join the conversation. Are you paying attention? Are you confident Washington is putting the country's energy house in order? Do you feel America's vulnerability and maybe your own if we get it wrong? What would it mean to get it right? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Dan Lashoff, senior scientist and deputy director of the Climate Center at the Resources Defense Council. Dan Lashoff, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We're also joined from Washington by Jason Grumet, Executive Director of the National Commission on Energy Policy, an independent bipartisan group formed by 18 of the nation's leading energy experts to develop energy strategy for the United States. Jason Grumet, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Dan Lashoff, first to you here. You see what's emerging from the Congress. I mean, we'll look at the House in a minute, but look at the Senate. People are talking about glasnost, about a centrist push to really do the right thing, whatever that might be, on energy, to take global warming into account. Do you see a new day dawning in Washington in seriousness, in ambition about taking on these problems or not?
Well, there's certainly a more cooperative spirit in the Senate on this bill right now, but there's a gaping hole in it, and that is with respect to our dangerous dependence on oil. The Senate bill does not have a serious program to reduce our oil consumption. The vote today, which narrowly defeated Cantwell's amendment, is a serious setback. Excuse me. The bill does have a provision that calls for the president to implement a plan to save about 1 million barrels of oil per day. We currently use about 20 million barrels a day.
And Maria Cantwell would have called for more than 7 million barrels a day to be replaced by non-oil energy sources.
That's right, through energy efficiency and alternative fuels.
By 2025, yeah.
By 2025. The current provision is by 2015, 1 million barrels a day. And that's a good start, except that it really lacks teeth and it lacks the additional authority that could be used to make that reduction easier to achieve and make the much bigger reductions that we need to achieve over time.
Dan, we've just got a minute before the break. I want to get Jason's top of mind here on the direction this legislation's going. Jason Grimet, do we have a breakthrough, or are we still headed, I don't know, into a wall here on the energy front? How do you read it, big picture?
I think we are certainly moving forward. I think that, as Justin said, the bipartisan tandem of Jeff Bingham and Pete Domenici from New Mexico have created a very different sense this year. This is the third Congress in a row that we have tried hard to pass an energy bill, and I think the third time, Tom, will probably be a charm in the Senate. I think the real action is going to be when the Senate and the House bills meet. That's when I think we may hit the wall.
And the wall is we won't get one passed again, or we'll pass something that's just not up to the challenge.
I think those would be the two concerns.
All kinds of walls there. Jason Grimet, Dan Lashoff, please stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking tonight about America's energy survival and the momentous bills on Capitol Hill right now. You can join us. With oil dwindling and climate change here, are you confident that Washington is getting the nation's energy house in order? Are we seriously preparing for the revolution that's coming at us? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We are talking tonight about America's energy survival and the momentous bills right now on Capitol Hill. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? From what you can see, from what you hear tonight, is Congress preparing to do the right thing? Or is it spending billions on boondoggles? And what is emerging as the Bush-era legacy to our energy future? Is Washington being ambitious enough, pushing for a more secure, greener energy supply? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Dan Lashoff with the Natural Resources Defense Council and Jason Grimet with the National Commission on Energy Policy. And Dan and Jason, I want to put to each of you so that we can get a context for this. I mean, you live in this world, but the rest of us check in at the gas pump and occasionally on policy. Maybe first to you, Dan, help us see a yardstick to hold Congress's performance up against. I mean, what's your vision of where the country needs to be at, I don't know what the year is, 2020, 2025? What's the vision of where it needs to be, and how do you then, you know, measure what Congress is working toward against that yardstick?
Well, I think there are probably three major energy challenges that we have to face. We have to provide increased reliability in our electricity supply and diversify the sources of electricity, increasing our renewable energy sources dramatically over that period. We need to reduce our dependence on oil, and we need to get serious about reducing the heat-trapping pollution that causes global warming. So, you know, the vision that I have for a serious energy plan would be a major effort to spur a technological revolution, really, in how we produce and consume energy, because we, in fact, have more leverage over our energy future by becoming more efficient in how we use energy than in just focusing on supply. And to do that, we need to have both ambitious targets but actually enforceable requirements to increase our energy efficiency, to increase our use of renewable energy, to reduce our oil consumption, and to reduce carbon dioxide and other global warming.
Okay, this used to be kind of high concept. It isn't anymore. We can all see at the gas pumps, we see the problem there with supply and price. We all see what a mess the Middle East is and could be worse, even that we're seeing right-wing security hawks saying, this is former Reagan Secretary of State George Shultz and former Clinton Director of the CIA James Woolsey saying, we have potential real security vulnerability here to terrorist attack on oil infrastructure. And we see the global warming. Just this last week, we've got scientists all over the place saying, it's real, it's here, it's now. So what Congress is doing right now really matters. Is it pushing toward the necessaries that you described there, Dan?
I don't think it goes nearly far enough, particularly with respect to oil consumption. The House bill would actually move us backwards, and the president has opposed even the very modest provision that's currently in the Senate bill.
Would move us backwards by what, by relying more on oil in coming years?
Well, it lavishes about 95% of the incentives in this House bill on conventional energy technologies, fossil fuels and nuclear power. It does almost nothing on energy efficiency, and it actually expands a loophole in our fuel efficiency laws that would increase our oil use. So that bill does nothing to prepare us for where we need to be in 10 or 20
years. So it sounds
like
you're giving the House an F. What about the Senate?
Well, the Senate, I would say, is maybe a C right now. I think the key... there was, you know, a significant improvement today with the adoption of the renewable portfolio standard for electricity, but a setback on oil.
The renewable portfolio, that's going to 10% from alternative energy by 2010, I think.
By 2020.
2020, excuse me.
So it's a pretty modest and slow start, but it's certainly a start. We'd like to see that, you know, double by 2020 compared with what they adopted today, but certainly the votes weren't there to be that ambitious.
But there's a step there. Jason Grimé, join us. Give us your vision. Look out, I don't know, 2020.
Tom,
what do we need to see?
I think, Tom, one thing worth realizing is that, you know, these problems have been many years in the making. There's a lot of negative momentum in our energy system right now.
What do you mean by that?
Every year, we become more dependent upon oil. Each and every year, the absolute amount of greenhouse gases emitted in this country grows by about 1.5%. Each and every year, our infrastructure becomes that much more decrepit and vulnerable to things like the cascading blackout that rendered us in darkness there a couple of years
back.
This
sounds lousy, but now we kind of get it. I mean, it was a little bit hypothetical, but now we see it at the pump. We see it in the Middle East.
Well, and so I guess, you know, in that context and looking at the politics of the possible, I think I'm a little more optimistic than Dan is about the efforts underway in the Senate.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, turning these curves are like turning the supertankers themselves around. It's going to take a while to move us from being a nation that grows ever and ever more dependent on oil, that becomes ever and ever more significant contributors to global warming, into a nation with a sustainable, secure, domestic energy policy. And that's one of the reasons why this is so tough politically. The senators and the members of Congress don't get to come home in 2 years and say, this is what I got you. You know, here are the cops on the street. Here's the new manufacturing facility.
Because it's longer term than that.
What they're challenged to do is to cast a long-term direction, and you know the costs of some of those changes will affect some special interests quite acutely, and the benefits are diffuse and there for us all. So I think in that context, the fact that the Senate has in fact moved forwards a meaningful compromise on ethanol that goes much farther than in the past to broaden ethanol beyond just kind of a Midwest corn focus to a program that actually has legitimate value nationwide that will bring other sources of ethanol production into play that will also improve some of the air quality requirements. The fact that the Senate has now passed a national requirement, albeit modest, for renewables is, I think, a significant step.
Jason, let me ask you, because I can feel this kind of suspicion out there, precisely because, as you say, the results are long-term and diffuse. Nevertheless, $16 billion is being earmarked here, and there's a kind of fear that, you know, behind a screen of lovely language, this could be given away, that there's boondoggles in the name of securing the energy future. Should we worry about that from your perspective, Jason Grimé, or not?
Absolutely, Tom. And I would say, first of all, welcome to Washington. But then I would also suggest that, you know, one of the real challenges here always is, where's the money going to come from? I mean, the fundamental challenge in enhancing our energy policy is in bringing forth the kinds of technologies that provide clean and low-cost, reliable energy. Someone's going to have to pay for those, and you really fundamentally have two choices. You can lay it on the tax base through incentive programs, or you can try to spread those costs through the market by bringing the downsides of oil security and the downsides of pollution to bear when you actually price energy products. So I think one of the real opportunities here that is before the Senate is with regard to climate change. There is a, some would say surprising, others would say shocking, opportunity that the United States Senate might actually move forward on a very meaningful economy-wide program that would kind of return the United States to the world community on taking climate change seriously.
And what would the core of that be? We're not going back to Kyoto, the president says, so what's the core of this change?
We are not going back to Kyoto, but the core of the change, and I take some personal pride here, our bipartisan commission spent 3 years trying to knock through an approach to climate change that would be meaningful, that would require the entire economy to actually get involved,
what
as opposed to a voluntary approach. It is an effort that would set a overall emission target for the nation. It would obligate us to slow growth in emissions over the next 5 to 10 years and then install an actual cap on emissions. It would essentially bring about a billion tons of greenhouse gas emissions, and it's hard to think about billions and tons of gases, but it would take those out of the airshed by 2020.
Is that going to rest on automobiles of individuals like me, or is it going to rest on factories reducing their emissions?
Well, the beauty here is that what we would do is place the obligation on the fossil fuels themselves, and so the high carbon containing fuels would bear the burden of the reductions.
How do you do that? You'd make oil somehow pay for its own reduction? How does that work?
You would require that at coal mines and oil refineries and natural gas pipelines at all of the imports juncture points of fossil fuels, that the companies who were bringing those fuels forth to the marketplace would have to surrender a certain amount of kind of permits or allowances in order to be able to sell the fuels into the system. And you would slowly ratchet down the total amount of carbon that would be allowed in the economy each year. And you would create a market signal so that there would be an incentive, which is absent right now, for efficient technologies and clean energy sources to actually reduce their carbon emissions. There would be a dollar to be made by an electric utility that could encourage energy efficiency. There would be a buck out there.
We're going to hear in just a moment from the chief economist at the American Petroleum Institute. But Dan Lashoff, I want to ask you first about big oil. Is it being, you know, held to account in the legislation that's on Capitol Hill now, or is it being lavished with billions it doesn't deserve? How do you see what's going on?
Well, the House bill certainly could be described as lavishing undeserved billions on the oil industry. And here even President Bush said at $55 or $56 a barrel for oil, we hardly need to put additional tax breaks to the oil industry. The Senate bill in its tax incentives is certainly more balanced, but it still contains a couple billion dollars going to the oil industry. And it contains something like $6 billion going to the nuclear power industry. Some of that far into the future and not actually counted in the budget scoring that they do on these tax bills. So that's being sort of underreported in how the Senate reports its bill. So there's certainly still problems there.
I want to turn right now to Fairfax, Virginia. We're joined there by John Felmy. He is chief economist at the American Petroleum Institute. It's the primary trade association of the petroleum business. Mr. Felmy, thank you for joining us tonight.
Good evening.
So you're looking at what's going on in the House and Senate. I'm sure your group has paid a lot of attention to sort of helping, you know, push its agenda in recent years. Do you see the right thing emerging here? It sounds like the House, at least as Dan Lashoff describes it, is very generous to the oil industry. The Senate is looking at global warming as a problem. Are you happy with the way legislation is? There's a long way to go, we know, but the way it's beginning to come together here.
Well, it's not over till it's over. Both bills are balanced bills in the sense of having energy efficiency, renewables, conservation, additional supplies of all energy, and infrastructure. We'll have to see what comes out of conference, but the key thing is this is an advancement. We hope it passes the Senate and gets to conference and that a bill is passed to the president.
Dan Lashoff says the House bill lavishes undeserved billions on the oil industry. That's yours. What do you say?
Well, that's simply not true. What it is a larger share goes to conventional fossil fuels, but that's where our energy comes from. So if you want to improve the situation for consumers, you support the places where you get your energy. Renewables only supply less than 0.5% of our energy supplies, so one has to be cautious about where you put your investments for additional energy.
But shouldn't, I mean, both because people talk about oil peaking out and because of global warming, shouldn't we be deliberately trying to move away from oil? I mean, I know it's your business, but as a, you know, human on the planet, shouldn't we be trying to get away from oil?
Well, global warming has no position in an energy bill. There's absolutely no reason to include it because what you want to do with energy bills is improve the situation for consumers. And virtually all the global warming provisions, whether it's McCain-Lieberman or Jason's NCEP recommendations, inflict burden on the economy and on consumers. It has no business in an energy bill. In terms of oil running out, well, we've had a expert of books and a lot of things that say that, but fundamentally people have been saying it for 100 years, and we're not ever going to run out of oil. It's a question of how expensive it gets.
John Filmy, with that last paragraph, you lost me. Global warming has no place
in an energy.
I don't understand that. Energy, the way we use energy is what has produced global warming, we're told. So how can you have an energy bill that doesn't think about that?
An energy bill should strictly be designed to improve the situation on energy for consumers. And so if you introduce global warming legislation, whether it is McCain-Lieberman, which would be inflict great economic damage on the economy, or even the NCEP, which actually could be characterized as a lot of pain and no gain because it won't achieve its targets anyway, that just shouldn't be included. If you want to look at the merits of that, irrespective of the discussion about the science, put that on separately in terms of discussion in the Senate.
I still don't get that. How do you? Of course, we know it's wonderful to have cheap gasoline and see the USA in your Chevrolet at low cost. But everybody, consumers, have also learned. I mean, know at this point that can also lead to real damage to the climate. I think people are concerned about that. I just don't see how you can say that doesn't belong. We know there's more at play here than just the price of gasoline at the pump.
Well, what you need, if you want to talk about the science, that's a different matter, and we could spend an entire program on that. But fundamentally, the state of the science is such that it does not justify the draconian climate change provisions that you're looking at. It certainly justifies doing a lot of things, such as technology improvement, as both Jason and Dan have said. It justifies trying to stimulate those technologies that get us out of the inefficient ways and so on. But it doesn't justify the mandates and draconian policies that people are talking about in this context.
Jason Grumet, you're our man in the middle here with your bipartisan group. John Filmy, chief economist, American Petroleum Institute, says global warming has no place in an energy bill. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, we've been having this conversation with John for about a decade, and he's been saying this consistently. I think that, you know, when we started to think about energy policy, John Holdren, who's a professor at Harvard and one of our co-chairs, began our first meeting by essentially saying that, you know, the hardest part of solving the energy challenge is the environment, and the hardest part of solving the environmental challenge is the energy system. So I just couldn't fundamentally agree with John Moore. I think that energy and the environment are inextricably linked together. The reason we have the problems we have today is that we've actually failed that basic fundamental test of sending good market incentives. We have failed to give people and the oil industry and the electric utility industry rational market-based incentives to make intelligent decisions about how to use our shared resources. It's certainly convenient for the American Petroleum Institute to prefer the status quo, because they are using the airshed. They are benefiting from the extent to which our nation is spending $40 billion a year to protect oil in the Persian Gulf, and they're not paying for it. So they have a really excellent deal, and I understand why they'd like to protect it.
Well, the rest of us
are suffering from that.
There's a chasm opened up. Let's hear from our callers on this. Mark is calling from McHenry, Illinois. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
We're good. What do you think?
Well, what I think is that these bills, whatever they're doing, are going to be too little, and unfortunately, they might already be too late, because, frankly, there's ample evidence that we are facing a global peak in oil quite soon. We may have already passed it. I don't believe for a moment the assertions coming from Saudi Arabia about the remaining reserves that they have in the ground. I wouldn't believe it if they showed me a picture, frankly. And the fact of the matter is that and all of these issues with energy with regard to making it more green are excellent things. We need to do that, but we also need to recognize that if global oil is peaking, we could be looking at a downturn and possibly a rapid downturn that you know, you can talk about the market correcting it and pricing correcting the problem, but when there's not enough fuel to run your vehicle.
Mark, let me ask you, do you trust right now as we sit here tonight that Washington is gearing up to do the right thing? It sounds like you don't, but why shouldn't they be? They're representing all of us.
I don't believe it for a moment because there's a report that was done by a gentleman, I think his name was Robert Hirsch, who talked about the fact that if we wait to answer the liquid fuel supply issue with regard to light duty vehicles, cars and trucks until oil has peaked, we could be looking at the potential for an economic downturn or depression that could last for 20 years.
Mark, we've got it. We thank you very much for your call. Our time is short before the break, and we just have John Filmy for another minute. Mr. Filmy, how can Americans trust? We have loved for years the gasoline that your industry has provided, but we can see the problems as well. You've got a lot of sway in Washington and a lot of money there. How can we trust that you're going to do the right thing by the country, not just by the industry?
Well, we're proposing to do the right things for consumers. We're proposing to have balanced energy policy that helps lower the cost to consumers, increases the reliability, and that is inconsistent with the mandates and other severe economic damage that's being proposed.
But so, what about the health of consumers and the planet they live on, their grandkids? Is that part of your concern?
Absolutely. And the thing of it is, in terms of criteria pollution, emissions, the air has gotten a lot cleaner over the last 20 years. And in terms of the global climate issues, I said, it's not an excuse not to do something, but it's not an excuse to adopt extremely costly mandates such are being proposed.
Draconian, your word. John Filmy, chief economist at the American Petroleum Institute, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
We're talking tonight about America's energy survival and the momentous bills on Capitol Hill. Dan Lashoff, Jason Grimet, please stand by. Listeners, you can join us. Is Washington being ambitious enough in pushing for a more secure, greener energy supply, or is this just too draconian, as our oil man says? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's energy survival and the momentous bills on Capitol Hill. You can join us. Is Congress poised to do the right thing or to spend billions on boondoggles? And what do you make of security hawks increasingly and greenies singing in harmony on energy? Do you trust the efforts underway in Washington? Are we headed for energy heaven, energy hell, somewhere in between? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm joined tonight by Dan Lashoff of the Natural Resource Defense Council and Jason Grumet of the National Commission on Energy Policy. Right now, David is calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Thanks very much, Tom. My point is that ethanol has a negative energy balance, that it takes more energy to produce ethanol than you can produce from it. Ethanol is generally from corn.
Yeah.
Corn is generally grown with ammonia, and ammonia comes from natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
In 1979, I did a study of this myself, and it's been true ever since that ethanol production is simply a sop to the agricultural industry, and it has nothing to do with improving our energy balance in the country. It's actually a negative effect.
Let us pick that up, David, and thanks very much for that. Dan Lashoff, how about it? I thought I heard you or Jason say something pretty positive about ethanol, but we've all heard this, that it costs more to produce it in energy terms than the savings in energy terms that you get from it. How do you see it, Dan?
Well, the industry has gotten more efficient since 1979, so the energy balance is improving. It takes more oil to produce a gallon of gasoline than is contained in the gasoline as well. So I think the real test is, are you getting value from the inputs? There's no question that...
What do you mean by that, value from the inputs?
Well, the question is the product more valuable than what you use to produce it? With ethanol, there are a lot of subsidies that call that into question, but there's no question that you reduce petroleum consumption when you use ethanol. And the way we make it right now from corn, you get only a modest benefit with respect to heat-trapping carbon dioxide emissions. I think the real promise from biofuels is by diversifying the feedstocks away from corn.
To what?
To agricultural waste, so-called cellulosic material. This is could be the corn stalks rather than having to use the corn.
The grain, so
itself.
Silage kind of.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You could grow switchgrass, which can be grown with far less ammonia input, less fertilizer, less tillage.
Does the legislation on the Hill encourage that with the billions that are going to sweeten the ethanol business?
It modestly does in the Senate bill. It's certainly a step in the right direction, although the bulk of the ethanol it would be produced under the bill would probably still come from corn for quite a time. So the key is to make that transition and to diversify the way we make ethanol.
Yeah, what
the other
you make
issue,
it from, yeah.
Yeah, it's what we make it from. And the other issue is how we use it and making sure that we use it in a way that doesn't degrade air quality. And the Senate bill, unfortunately, is deficient in that regard.
Jason Grimet, this is the kind of thing that starts to get under our skin and drive us a little crazy. Is it just moving billions around to satisfy Midwestern farm state senators? Or do we have a real gain here? I mean, we don't want to waste time and money with the problems we've got looming out there.
I think that's exactly right, Tom. And I think, the caller, I believe it was David,
yes,
makes a point. He cited a study in 1979. And I think in 1979, his point was probably accurate. We have made quite a bit of progress, as Dan said, learning how to make ethanol more efficiently. And the overall energy balance, if you think about it in terms of greenhouse gas emissions is that, you know, a gallon of even corn-based ethanol is about 20% better for, you know, climate change than a, you know, running a car on a gallon of gasoline.
So environmentally, it's good. And what about the...
It's a step in the right direction.
But there's the positive-negative balance. I mean, if you're going to use other petroleum to produce that ethanol, do you end up with a net gain?
Well, no. I guess what I'm saying is that even in the kind of the, you know, lowest tech, just make ethanol out of corn kernels, there's a positive gain of about 20%.
Okay.
But as Dan was saying, the real opportunity is the opportunity to move beyond food crops to truly kind of renewable crops, whether it's switchgrass or whether it's using waste products, whether it's using the corn stover.
But he says the Senate bill is barely doing that, and the House version doesn't.
Little farther than barely. I mean, the Senate bill provides a 2.5-to-1 kind of credit ratio to provide an additional incentive by 2.5 times to 1 for gallons of ethanol made from this cellulosic material.
Yep.
And some of the billions that we are all worried about are going to provide the incentives to turn the cellulosic ethanol from kind of a boutique small-scale production to real commercial-scale production.
So maybe it's a step in the right direction there. Dan, I want to turn back, if we may, for a minute to what John Felmy was saying from the American Petroleum Institute. I mean, some pretty hot stuff there. He says that any restrictions on petroleum here are draconian, that, you know, this bill should have nothing to do with global warming. I mean, what do you make of this? And how much sway does the oil industry have in Washington right now? Is it writing the legislation?
Well, John Felmy and the American Petroleum Institute is really fundamentally out of touch, not only with environmental advocates like NRDC, but with leaders in his own industry, like Lord Brown, the head of BP, who signed a statement that was issued last week, along with over 20 other CEOs of major global businesses, calling for immediate action to reduce global warming pollution, calling for just the kind of limits on emissions and market signals that the National Commission on Energy Policy has recommended.
Well, you can say he's out of touch, but Exxon is not on that wavelength, we read recently, and the American Petroleum represents hundreds of big American oil companies. So,
well, I think they really fundamentally represent Exxon, and that's the problem. You know, and Exxon, as was reported last week, one of the American Petroleum Institute lobbyists had been in the White House Council on Environmental Quality rewriting scientific reports on global warming to downplay the risk.
And now he's gone back to work for Exxon.
Now he's gone back to work at Exxon.
But let me ask you, our time is so short, I want to get to the point here. I want to get to this point, Dan. After all this debate and all this this element of hope, this centrist coalition, is it going to come back around to a kind of legislation written at Exxon headquarters and stamped by Capitol Hill?
I certainly hope not. And I think that the critical point down the road is going to be the conference between the House bill, which really does reflect pretty much straight down the line the interests of Exxon and the oil industry and the coal industry, and a Senate bill, which I think will emerge probably next week, much more balanced, a step in the right direction, not really as big a step as measures up to the challenge that we face, but would certainly be seen as something positive. But then the question is, when they go into the back rooms and conference, what emerges there? And that's where the energy bill has faltered in the past. And we'll just have to see how that plays out.
Let's get one more call here. Brian is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great to be on. My question was, you know, I've heard a lot about little steps and, you know, getting there eventually through all these bills.
Yeah.
But this stuff, a lot of it still sounds kind of like what happened in the 70s with our, you know, cars got bigger, engines got bigger. Then we learned our lesson in the fuel crisis.
Got whacked down.
Yeah, whacked back down. And now it's happening again. So I want to know what's going to be like the tipping point when we actually start moving really in the right direction. I heard someone mention something about negative inertia, and I definitely understand that cars are still, you know, getting bigger.
Yep.
When are we going to wise up, and are we really going to start seeing a revolution in our energy usage to much more smarter, greener, renewable, and less environmentally harmful ways?
Brian, it's a great question. Thanks for raising it. Jason Grimet, what do you say? Do you see a tipping point where you know, special interests just get pushed aside because the national interest is so clearly, severely on the table?
I think if you see real leadership coming from the Congress and from the White House, you can capture that moment. But I guess I take a slightly different view, which is that the new products that are out there, the hybrid vehicles, are just simply better cars They're better to drive. You save a lot of money on gasoline. They have more power.
So what's your point? They're going to take over the roads without any intervention?
My point is that we are at a moment where we have some real technological opportunities to capitalize on. And I guess that's the key point that, Dan was making also. If we do not take action to make sure that we see some of this technological benefit for the public good, we will have, you know, 5,000-pound, 500-horsepower hybrid vehicles that get no better fuel economy.
You're saying the market won't do it alone. You need Capitol Hill to do something to encourage it?
Right, but we have a combination. We have real technologies now, and now the Congress and the White House have to seize this opportunity and do something for the public good.
It's 2005 already. Are they going to do it this year?
I believe they are, and I think, you know, we've talked about this House-Senate conference in kind of in passing a whole lot. That's where it's really going to happen. I mean, the House essentially passed, you know, last year's Oldsmobile. They passed last year's energy bill.
Yep.
They didn't have a lot of time for debate. And they basically challenged the Senate to say, you know, we'll meet you in conference. And so, you know, the real rubber will hit the road when we get there. I think we're going to have a Senate bill that will have a renewable mandate for clean energy. It will have action on climate change.
Subsidies if I buy a low-emission car.
Incentives. We're going to have a House bill that doesn't have many of those provisions.
What's the timetable, Mr. Grimet? When is this conference likely to take place?
I think the fall of this year is the best guess.
Oh, boy. So time to really dig in and watch and see what's coming. Well, you're both great, and we're very grateful to you for being with us tonight. Jason Grimet, Executive Director of the National Commission on Energy Policy, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
And Dan Lashoff, Deputy Director of the Climate Center at the Natural Resource Defense Council. Dan, it's terrific having you tonight. Thanks a lot for being with us.
It was great talking to you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, testing shellfish for the toxins that come with red tide. This is On Point. What is being described as the worst outbreak of red tide ever has closed shellfish beds up and down the northeastern seaboard, driving up shellfish prices nationally and costing the shellfish industry more than $3 million a week. Red tide is caused by rust-colored algae that contaminates clams, oysters, and other mollusks that strain seawater for food and can make them dangerous to eat. Scientists blame a confluence of meteorological conditions for this year's big outbreak, which is expected to last for several more weeks and could persist until the fall. More than a third of the nation's shellfish come from New England's waters. On Point contributor Scott Haas recently visited the inspection lab of Legal Seafoods, a chain of restaurants based in Boston, to see how scientists there respond to the threat of red tide.
We're inside a very large arrival area of a fish plant in downtown Boston. It's the plant that it's attached to Legal Seafoods. I'm here with Roger Berkowitz, the CEO of Legal Seafoods. Roger, how much fish arrives here every day typically? How many tons of fish?
I mean, anywhere from 8 to 12 tons.
8 to 12 tons.
Could come in at a given time. And that could be, you know, anything from shrimp, different varieties, you know, lobster, clams.
Well, here are the culprits, Roger.
Yeah, well, here are, you know, now you don't see, now if you see a red tag.
We're standing in a room where there are about two or three dozen bags of clams.
Right.
And these
and
are,
mussels.
And mussels.
Yeah.
And these are the culprits. These are the things that everyone's worried about.
Exactly.
Now, these are okay, though, right?
These are all right.
Now, how do you know just by looking at them? You're not just
looking.
Well,
first of all, you see the place of origin. I mean, we're taking a look at mussels over here. You know, it has the tag on it. Shows where it's been raised. These are Prince Edward Island.
So that's not where the red tide is from.
Not where the red tide is from. And so, and then we test it. We hold it in quarantine just to be on the safe side. And as long as the test comes back negative, then you're perfectly fine.
Show me these bags of clams. These are the clams that everyone's worried about.
Yeah. Now,
not only these particular clams.
Okay. Now these are coming out of Connecticut.
Okay.
Okay. And so this area of Connecticut. It's far enough away from any of the potential tide.
So it's marked area 663 Connecticut, and it says
right.
Quart neck half bushel.
Count neck, yeah. And then, but there's, again, just to be on the safe side, we then put them through a series of tests. And again, as long as it comes back negative, then they're released.
And these here, these big boxes, are all farm-raised oysters, so they're totally safe no matter what.
Well, you know what? But also, you've got to double-check to make sure that they're not, you know, in basins where red tide could grow out of. So, nonetheless, they're still checked. We don't take anything for granted. We don't assume anything when it comes to shellfish.
In addition to this area here where everything's arriving, there's an area where you test for these things?
Yes, we have a laboratory outside of this area. The laboratory is sort of the one area that's not under refrigeration. If you notice, everything
is
held in refrigeration, right? Because that's where, you know, fish and shellfish sort of thrive and they don't break down. But outside we have pretty much a state-of-the-art laboratory.
Can you take me to this laboratory?
Sure.
What we see here looks like the kind of lab you might see in a hospital. There's lots of really cool-looking glass vials, and there's three guys looking pretty cool in white lab coats. Hi. Tell me your name, please.
I'm Stephen Montanello. I'm Director of Quality Control.
Is it possible to do a test on a shellfish here right now or not?
We just finished actually doing like around 11 samples from different bed areas. But basically what we do is we grind up the shellfish meats in a sterile blend of dilution water. And then we put them in these test tubes that have broth in it. And if the bacteria is present, they'll utilize the sugar that's in the broth and produce a methane gas. If we come in the next morning and find the tubes all bubbly, then we realize that there's some bacteria in there that shouldn't be there.
I'm assuming that the state of Massachusetts is testing shellfish beds as well. What is different about this lab compared to what the state labs are doing?
Well, the state lab usually tests a lot of water. They take samples of water from the area. And then they decide exactly what's in it. They do water quality tests, and they also do the same kind of tests for the red tide. How we strictly work with the shellfish meats. We want to see exactly what product we're giving to the guests.
So the state, per se, is not testing the shellfish? They're testing the water?
They do some shellfish testing, but not a lot.
Wow, that's fast. So do you share your information with the state?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Is that under contract? Is it informal? I mean,
it's informal.
Informal.
It's mostly informal. I know the shellfish inspector for the state. And if anything ever comes up that's ever bad or concerning, and I let him know.
Mm-hmm.
So then he can concentrate on that area.
Typically, you know, companies want to fight government regulations and say we want less regulation. But what's going on here is actually this strange sort of private-public partnership, it seems. I don't know.
Well, I think that the state and what we're looking for and what the state are looking for are the same,
mm-hmm.
and we're on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever they can do to help us and whatever we can do to help them is great.
Roger, I wanted to ask you something over here, too. I mean, what would you tell people this summer about shellfish?
You know, if you have any concern about the shellfish that you'd like to consume in a given place, whether it's a restaurant or a market, always ask the people there, can I see your shellfish tags? Because by law, at least in Massachusetts, you have to have your tags.
What do the tags refer to?
And the tags refer to the place the product was harvested from. Now, if they don't know what you're talking about, they're saying, well, what are you? Then it's a good indication you don't have to go any further. Just don't consume them there.
Thanks. And are you going to eat shellfish this summer?
Yes, I will. Especially if I buy it here.
Right, I was going to say, yes, if you personally have inspected the shelf. Well, thank you both very much. I really appreciate it, and I've learned a lot. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
On Point contributor Scott Haas, visiting the inspection lab of Legal Seafoods, a chain of restaurants along the eastern seaboard. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.